Let's talk about photosynthesis now, which is the next chapter. And it will really pay off in terms of understanding photosynthesis if you have a good grasp on cellular respiration, which we just finished. Cellular respiration is just part of the complete oxidation of glucose or carbohydrate fuel, right? Glycolysis is the first part. Well, if you consider the complete oxidation of glucose, it has a reciprocal relationship with photosynthesis, which means they undo each other, right? Another way of saying that is that the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose, which is not how it happens, right? The summary reaction is just listing the start and the finish, ignoring all the intermediate steps, just acting like it's all one reaction. That summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose is the reverse of the summary reaction for photosynthesis, which is why I'm saying they have a reciprocal relationship. So let's actually just say what those summary reactions are. What's the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose? What are your reactants? Glucose and oxygen, right? Become what? Water and carbon dioxide, with the release of a lot of usable energy. That energy gets put into the form of building the ATPs. Okay? So just the reverse of that is the summary reaction for photosynthesis. A photosynthetic organism, like a plant, for instance, needs the output, the two outputs that the complete oxidation of glucose provides, right? So the plant starts with carbon dioxide and water, and it uses the carbon in those carbon dioxide molecules that it's taking in to build up an organic molecule made up of a carbon skeleton. So the output of photosynthesis is sugar. Now, it's not directly glucose, as we'll see, but it can be made into glucose. But it's an organic sugar. That's the output of photosynthesis. And oxygen. So it's the complete reverse of the summary reaction. Importantly, though, that does not mean that photosynthesis is just the oxidation of glucose run in reverse. Now, we talked about the reciprocal relationship of glycolysis versus gluconeogenesis, right, which are effectively the reverse of each other, and in fact are the reverse of each other in parts. There are certain enzymes that, those bypass enzymes that we talked about. So it's almost that gluconeogenesis is glycolysis run in reverse. Well, it's not even close for photosynthesis. They have the reverse summary reactions, but they happen totally differently. And, in fact, using totally different organelles, right? Cellular respiration, which is part of the oxidation of glucose, occurs in the mitochondrion, assuming we're talking about eukaryotes, which we are usually, whereas photosynthesis occurs in the chloroplast of a eukaryotic cell. Also, I should say that photosynthesis occurs entirely in the chloroplast, whereas the complete oxidation of glucose starts out in the cytosol, that's where glycolysis occurs, and then ends up in mitochondrion, because that's where cellular respiration occurs. Well, we're looking at a chloroplast in slide one. So we should mention that a chloroplast, like a mitochondrion, is a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, not just singly membrane-bounded. So there's an outer membrane and an inner membrane for a chloroplast. And therefore, there is an intermembrane space also in a chloroplast. There's actually a third membrane, though, which really derives from the inner membrane, but it's kind of officially pinched off, so it's become its own membrane. And that membrane is the thylakoid membrane, which is highly elaborate. Just like the inner membrane of the mitochondrion is highly elaborate, meaning highly folded, the thylakoid membrane is folded up into an elaborate shape that makes it look like a bunch of stacks of coin-like bags that we see on the top. All of that green, all of that same color green, is one membrane folded elaborately to make it look like stacks of coins. Well, the thylakoid membrane is called this because each of these little coin-like sacs, which is not a separate thing, like I said, they're all connected, is called a thylakoid. A single stack of thylakoids, and there's many stacks, but a single stack is called a granum, G-R-A-N-U-M, the plural of which is grana. So the one thylakoid membrane, because of its elaboration, forms several grana, each of which contains or is made up of several thylakoids. And this happens exactly for the same reason that you have Christi in the mitochondrion, which is what? No, I mean, why fold, though? Right. And it's a drastic increase in surface area. And the reason that's important is because, just like in cellular respiration, photosynthesis requires membrane-bound proteins to do the job, and it also will feature pumping of protons. Part of photosynthesis occurs very much like cellular respiration, which is why I said understanding cellular respiration will make understanding photosynthesis easier. Okay, that's why we have so much thylakoid membrane. We're looking at an extreme close-up of just a few thylakoids in a granum right here in this cartoon. And another major point of this slide, beyond the anatomy of it, is that overall photosynthesis occurs in two major sets of reactions, two major phases of photosynthesis, in other words, which this book calls the energy transduction reactions and the carbon assimilation reactions, which are good descriptive phrases, actually. But not all books call them that. These used to be called, in the olden days, the light reactions and the dark reactions. The light reactions, named for the fact that light is required in this first phase. That kind of fell out of favor eventually because when you call the other set of reactions the dark reactions, it kind of implies that you need darkness for those to happen, when that's not true. It's just that you don't need light. It'll still happen when light's there. You just don't need the light for those reactions. So eventually they were changed to the light-dependent reactions and the light-independent reactions, which are still in use by many books. Anyway, this book is calling what other books would call the light-dependent reaction. This one's calling the energy transduction reactions. And notice the plural. It's not just a single reaction. It's a biochemical pathway. And what other books would call the light-independent reactions are called the carbon assimilation reactions. But these ones actually, these phrases actually tell you what's going on more than just saying whether or not light is required. Energy transduction reactions are necessary because photosynthetic organisms do not have the ability to directly use light energy to build sugars out of inorganic carbon in the form of carbon dioxide. This is very similar to the situation I talked about when we were talking about cellular respiration. We animals, or anything that has a mitochondrion, don't have the ability to directly use the energy released from the food molecules that we catabolize to do the various kinds of cellular work, right? That's not how we do it. We use energetic middlemen, right? That's why we build up ATP, because ATP is versatile. It can be spent anywhere to do any kind of work, almost. So that's where we put the energy of our fuel, temporarily into ATP, and then ATP can directly power the various kinds of cellular work that we talked about. Well, similarly, a plant can't take light energy and directly build a sugar using that. So the energy needs to be stored temporarily into a form that can then be used to build sugar. That's the purpose of the energy transduction reactions, or the light-dependent reactions. And there are two forms of energy that get created as temporary storage in the light reactions or energy transduction reactions. Those two forms of energy are ATP and one that we haven't talked about, but that's very similar to one we've talked about. That is NADPH, not NADH. NADPH. So a photosynthetic organism will use NADH and NADPH to do the same thing, to carry energy around, which can be used by having those coenzymes drop their electrons off somewhere. But by having both versions, one that's phosphorylated, one that's not phosphorylated, they can use these two energy-storing molecules for separate purposes. For catabolic purposes in the mitochondrion, that's NADH, and for anabolic purposes, which is what photosynthesis is, right? You're building up an organic molecule out of carbon dioxide, which is inorganic. Well, that's what NADPH is used for. So they have separate fleets of taxis, basically, for these kind of opposite purposes. So that's, as far as energy is concerned, that's the big deal about the energy transduction reactions. You have to get that light energy into a form that's usable later to actually do the work of assembling an organic molecule, a sugar, out of inorganic carbon dioxide. And it's not, ATP alone does not do the job. You have to have both kinds of energy, NADPH and ATP. So that's what happens in the energy transduction reactions, and that's the part that is very similar to cellular respiration. Notice that you have ATP synthase molecules here in the thylakoid membrane that are going to work exactly like they do in cellular respiration, meaning that a proton gradient having been established will cause these things to spin and cause the oxidative phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. Same exact mechanism. All right? But this is not ATP that the plant is trying to make for the purposes of doing generalized work, like it is when you make ATP the same way in the mitochondrion. This is ATP that it needs as one energetic ingredient to build up a molecule of sugar. Okay? The NADPH, we'll talk about how that happens in a minute. But in the light-dependent reactions or energy transduction reactions, this is also when the photosynthetic organism produces O2. Remember, O2 is on the right side of the summary reaction for photosynthesis. It gets spit out. It's an input for cellular respiration. It's an output for photosynthesis. Well, that happens because water gets split in the light-dependent reactions, forming oxygen. Notice that's just the opposite of what happens in the oxidation of glucose. Oxygen's an input. It serves as the final electron acceptor, and by receiving those electrons becoming reduced along with the protons, it becomes water, the reduced form of oxygen. Here, water, the reduced form of oxygen, in a sense, gets oxidized to O2, the opposite reaction. Okay, now the carbon assimilation reactions is also a nice descriptive way of otherwise saying, talking about the light-independent reactions, because it tells you the important thing that's occurring in there. Carbon assimilation refers to incorporating inorganic carbon into an organic compound. There's another word that's used besides assimilation when we're talking about doing that. What is that word? Anyone know? Well, it is a synthesis. Overall, it's a synthesis, which is why it's photosynthesis, because you are anabolizing. You're bringing together smaller things to make a bigger thing. But specifically, when we're talking about taking carbon from an inorganic source and incorporating it into an organic compound, that's called carbon assimilation or carbon what? Fixation. Carbon fixation. So photosynthesis fixes carbon. Now, it's good that that photosynthetic organisms do that, because we wouldn't exist otherwise. You know, that's the essence of a producer. A producer fixes carbon so that there are organic molecules that not only allows them to live, but allows all the consumers of the world to live as well. Because the consumers don't fix carbon. They have to rely on organic compounds as their source of carbon. The carbon dioxide that's in the air doesn't help them. It's unavailable to them as organic. As a source of carbon for organic compounds. They have to, you know, this is why we eat things that are made up of organic compounds already. The carbon dioxide doesn't help us. So that's the big thing that's happening in the carbon assimilation reactions, or carbon fixation reactions, you could call them. The main feature of the carbon assimilation reactions is the Calvin cycle. In the Calvin cycle, you take carbon dioxide, which is noted as listed as an input here, inorganic carbon, there's no CH bonds, and you incorporate it into a triose. So the direct output of photosynthesis is not glucose, like I said. The direct output of photosynthesis is a triose, a three-carbon sugar. But once you have trioses, you have organic compounds to work with, which can be combined to form hexoses, including glucose. And then you can combine hexoses as monosaccharides into disaccharides or polysaccharides. So once you have that organic sugar formed from the Calvin cycle, you can do anything you want to with it carbohydrate-wise, but also you can start sticking other things on as well and form the other kinds of organic macromolecules, not just carbohydrates. All right? So it's a source of carbon skeletons, which are now organic, that you didn't have in the form of CO2. So it's very versatile. It's not just that plants make sugar and that's all they can make. They can make the other kinds of macromolecules out of those sugars. All right, now let's go to two. Well, not a hell of a lot of new information in slide two. It's just another view of the anatomy. We can see a granum is listed here. Like I said, there are several grana within one chloroplast, and there are several chloroplasts within one cell. I mean, it varies, of course, but a typical plant cell will have 50 chloroplasts in a single cell. And so there's a lot of copies of these important membrane-bound proteins that we're going to talk about at work simultaneously in an overall plant, because, of course, it's billions of cells big, trillions of cells big if you have a big plant. Anyway, I did mention the intermembrane space. That's just one compartment within the chloroplast. There's actually three compartments, though. You can be inside the chloroplast, inside the inner membrane, but outside of the thylakoids, right? So you pass through both the outer membrane and the inner membrane, and you're in a compartment that's called the stroma, which you should be careful with the spelling of, because plants also have mouth-like openings called stomata, and the singular of which is stoma. Stoma is a hole, stroma is the stuff that fills the interior of the chloroplast, but that's only the second of three compartments. You also have a compartment inside the thylakoid membrane. So inside each coin, and that's all one space because of what I said before. It's all one membrane, so the coins aren't separate from each other. And that compartment is called the thylakoid space. All right, so just like cellular respiration featured the pumping of protons through a membrane, specifically from the matrix to the intermembrane space, there is going to be the pumping of protons through the thylakoid membrane in photosynthesis in order to set up that gradient that I was talking about that will produce ATP as one of the necessary energetic carriers that the Calvin cycle or the carbon assimilation reactions will require. Three. Well, here we have not a plant. This is not even an alga. By the way, those are the two major kinds of eukaryotic photosynthesizers. You have plants, which we tend to think of more often than anything else when we talk about photosynthesis. But there are plenty of other eukaryotic organisms that are photosynthetic as well. Those collectively are called algae. And the singular, by the way, of algae is alga. So an alga is eukaryotic. It's specifically a eukaryotic protist. A protist is, by the way, any eukaryote that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. So it's kind of a catch-all term. Well, some protists are photosynthetic, some aren't. Photosynthetic protists, though, are called algae collectively, some of which are unicellular, some of which are multicellular. The point here is, though, that they're all eukaryotes, so they all have chloroplasts of some sort. Well, photosynthesis was around for a long time before that first chloroplast even existed. Bacteria got it started. They were the first photosynthesizers of the world. And there's still many, many of those, and they're important sources of photosynthesis, especially in the oceans. Well, they accomplish photosynthesis even though they, of course, don't have chloroplasts, because by definition, prokaryotes don't have membrane-bounded organelles. They are able to do this, though, just by elaborating their only membrane that they have, which is their plasma membrane. So these photosynthetic membranes that are listed here, really just an infolding of the plasma membrane, accomplishing the same thing. Actually, the slide four now, the infolding of the plasma membrane in a photosynthetic prokaryote explains why we have chloroplasts to begin with. And similarly, the infolding of a respiratory membrane, which is a plasma membrane that's been folded in an aerobic prokaryote, explains the existence of mitochondria. What we're looking at here in cartoon form is what's called the endosymbiont theory, or the endosymbiotic theory, for the existence of mitochondria and chloroplasts. This really explains our ancestors, we as eukaryotes, I mean, not just animals, any eukaryote. Starting with a proto-eukaryote at the top, what this is actually an archaean, so a member of archaea, not a bacterium, the other kind of prokaryote, or a direct offshoot of archaea. We're not exactly sure what this cell was, but it's archaean in its makeup, which is why this is why we as eukarya, or as eukaryotes, members of eukarya, are more similar to archaea than we are, than either of us is to bacteria. That's why, you know, that's the three domains of life. It's because the cell, the big outer cell that we're talking about in this picture is archaean. Okay? It's this archaean cell, or proto-eukaryote, because it's on its way to becoming a eukaryote, is an anaerobic cell. And this is a couple billion years ago, we have fossilized evidence for eukaryotes dating back at least 1.8 billion years ago. So we know that eukaryotes existed certainly by then. We don't know how much early, but roughly 2 billion years ago, which is roughly 1.5 to 2 billion years after life first existed on Earth, because the prokaryotes started at least 3.5 billion years ago. We have fossil evidence of prokaryotic cells dating that far back. So to earn that early history of life, you had only prokaryotic cells, different kinds, of course, during this first couple billion years of life, but that's all you had. Only unicellular prokaryotes, life only in the ocean, nothing on land yet. Eukaryotes came about, though, because an archaean cell that's listed here as the proto-eukaryote was going about its business engulfing other cells as food and living an anaerobic lifestyle. There wasn't much oxygen in the atmosphere at this time. It was building up because of relatively new development, photosynthesis. There was no oxygen originally. The oxygen came from the fact that photosynthetic organisms produced it little by little, and that's why we have oxygen in the atmosphere today. So back then, there were certain aerobic cells, there were certain other anaerobic cells. Our ancestor, the proto-eukaryote, was anaerobic. And it was going around phagocytizing or engulfing other cells as a way of living. The endosymbiosis theory, which there's a lot of evidence to support, says that this cell engulfed an aerobic bacterium. So an archaeal cell engulfed an aerobic bacterium. In other words, a bacterium that's able to undergo cellular respiration because of its elaborately folded membrane. And for whatever reason, one of these times, this aerobic bacterium survived the process of being engulfed. Instead of being killed and broken down for food, the bacterium took up residence in the cell that engulfed it. So now you have a cell that's partly archaean and partly bacterial, right? A cell within a cell. This is what the first mitochondrion was. Now, the very strong lines of evidence supporting this, it almost certainly happened, we just don't know exactly how it happened, is that, first of all, the mitochondrion is doubly membrane-bounded. Well, a bacterium with one membrane, when it gets engulfed, it's going to be wrapped by a membrane of the cell engulfing it. So that alone explains having two membranes. When you microscopically examine or molecularly examine the inner membrane and the outer membrane of a mitochondrion, the inner membrane is very bacterial-like, whereas the outer membrane is like the host cell. Also, mitochondria have their own DNA. Not only do they have their own DNA, it's arranged in a circular chromosome, like a bacterial chromosome. So they have their own genes separate from the nuclear genes. And they also have their own ribosomes, so they can do their own transcription and translation, build their own proteins. And if you look at those ribosomes, they are similar to bacterial ribosomes. They're different from the ribosomes that are out in the cytoplasm, which are eukaryotic ribosomes. All right? And finally, mitochondria reproduce within the cell by binary fission. They split into two new mitochondria, just like a bacterium does when it's free living. So, very strong evidence for this actually happening. Why the bacterium survived, who knows why it happened that way, but it did, yeah.
Didn't you mention something about lipids and cholesterols? Membrane?
Yeah, that's what I mean when I just kind of used a catch-all phrase saying that molecularly the inner membrane is more bacterial than eukaryotic. All right, so that is our ancestor. Now we have a a cell that has a mitochondrion, and our own cells have mitochondria, right? Once that happened, because mitochondria can reproduce just like bacteria can, when the cell reproduces, the progeny cells are going to have their own mitochondria, and it's happened that way ever since. But that is our ancestor. Now, one of the progeny of this original cell that had the original mitochondrion later on did the same thing with a photosynthetic bacterium, engulfed a photosynthetic bacterium, which for whatever reason survived that process. So that offshoot now has both mitochondria and chloroplasts, and that's the ancestor to all the photosynthetic eukaryotes, right? Because they have both. By the way, all the strong lines of evidence for supporting endosymbiotic theory that I said for mitochondria are also true for chloroplasts. They have their own DNA and so on. Okay, so it's important to remember that a plant does not just have chloroplasts, it has mitochondria as well. And for the same reason, it uses its mitochondria to complete the oxidation of its fuels to make ATP for its various jobs that it has to perform that are endergonic, just like for us. But it also has chloroplasts, which will produce the carbon skeletons of organic molecules that it can use to build its various structures. And that's why it's pretty self-sufficient as long as you give it light. It's a producer. Now, there's, of course, ecological interrelationships between consumers and producers in both directions, but they are more self-sufficient than we are. We absolutely rely on them, which is why leading to their demise through global warming is going to bite us in the ass. Okay, slide 5. The two graphs that we're looking at here are examples of, well, the top one is an example of an absorption spectrum, which if you have the laboratory component of this course, you should already be familiar with. It's just graphing the amount of absorbance that occurs for any given wavelength. Light is electromagnetic radiation. It's electromagnetic energy. And what we call light is usually, what we mean by that phrase is light that happens to be humanly visible. But light or electromagnetic radiation includes a bunch of invisible stuff as well, right? Infrared light, gamma rays, radio waves, microwaves. Well, the radio waves and the microwaves, those are on the low energy end. Those are invisible because they're not energetic enough to activate our eyes. The dangerous stuff on the other end, the ultraviolet stuff, is invisible for being too energetic. The wavelengths aren't right for those too low and too high forms of electromagnetic energy to actually interact with the cells in our retina. But even though photosynthesis has nothing to do with humans, it's also true that humanly visible light is the range that's used by photosynthetic organisms. All right, so chlorophyll is the chief photosynthetic pigment. A pigment is simply a compound that is able to absorb some form of light. Now, we know pigment as colored things, but that's why they're colored to us. Since they absorb some of the light, that means they don't reflect all of it back to our eyes. And the part that does get reflected back is what causes the color sensation to happen in our brain. All right? So pigments absorb light. You have to have a pigment if you're going to be a photosynthetic organism, because if you don't absorb the light, you can't get any of the energy to put to use to make NADPH and ATP. Well, chlorophyll, like I said, is the main photosynthetic pigment, but there are two versions of it, A and B, and notice that they have different absorption spectra. But what they have in common is that they're both green, and the reason they look green to us is because they don't absorb green wavelength light very well. All right, so you don't want to lock a plant in the closet giving it only green light. You're going to starve it, because green light does not get absorbed well. That gets bounced back to our eyes and makes it look green to us. So chlorophyll does a good job of absorbing red and blue light on the ends of this spectrum. And so that's the light that gets put to use via chlorophyll, gets absorbed by chlorophyll to be put to use to make these energetic compounds in the first phase of photosynthesis. The bottom graph is what's called an action spectrum. Here, if you actually put, for instance, algae, which some algae are unicellular, if you spread them on a slide, and then you shine white light through a prism so that it refracts into the spectrum, and therefore individual cells will get different colors of light, and then you measure their amount of photosynthesis, you can make this graph. And what this shows you is that the ones that are happening to get the green light are not doing very much photosynthesis because they can't absorb that light very well. But the ones on the ends are undergoing a lot. Well, there's still, slide six now, there's still a lot of light available in that range that isn't accessible, though, or isn't absorbable by chlorophyll, which is why photosynthetic organisms don't have just chlorophyll. It's the chief one, like I said, but they also have what are called accessory pigments. And you see some listed here, beta-carotene, lutein, phycoerythrin, phycocyanin, different colors because they have different absorption spectra. And if you have a combination of these things, then that means you can take advantage of a greater fraction of this amount of light that's coming in as sunlight. But this also explains why different photosynthetic organisms are different colors. Like you have red algae, you have brown algae, you have green algae, and so on. 7. This is a structural formula for chlorophyll, actually for two molecules. It's both chlorophyll A and B, which are almost identical. This is all one molecule, but notice the box at the top. If that little corner is a CHO, then you have chlorophyll B. If it's a CH3, a methyl group, then you have chlorophyll A. That's the only difference between the two. But that makes a difference, as you saw in the absorption spectrum, as to what kind of light they absorb best. So plants or other photosynthetic organisms will have both chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B. The business end of this thing is the top with the magnesium atom in this cluster. That's what makes it act as a pigment. That's what actually absorbs the light. Sticking off of that, though, you have a long chain. And what is true of this tail? It's a hydrocarbon, exactly. There's nothing but carbons and hydrogens here. Remember that every corner is a carbon, and you have to imagine as many hydrogens as are necessary to satisfy the valence. So there's a bunch of carbons and hydrogens in this, even though only some of them are listed here. Why would you have such a thing? Exactly right. Hydrocarbon is nonpolar, right? Because carbon and hydrogen have equal electronegativities. They're nonpolar, just like a fatty acid is nonpolar. They're both hydrocarbon chains. And so this phytol side chain, as it's called, this hydrocarbon chain that includes these phytol side chains, that has no problem being right beside the phospholipid, the fatty acid tails of the phospholipids that make up the thylakoid membrane. So this hydrocarbon tail anchors the chlorophyll molecules in the thylakoid membrane. They can still move around. It just keeps them in the membrane. They can move side to side, as we talked about. But the part that's actually doing the absorbing of photons, that's the other end. that's sticking out of the membrane. Now to A. We're going to talk about two different kinds of photosystems that are used in photosynthesis. A photosystem is not a single protein. It's a bunch of proteins complexed together, and it's actually more than just protein as well. But it's a huge structure of made up of many proteins that, along with many chlorophyll molecules. Okay? You can see chlorophyll molecules clustered in here along with protein subunits. So many different polypeptides and many different chlorophylls of both types, A and B, make up one photosystem. And there's many, many copies of both types of photosystems. All right? But a photosystem is a working unit on its own, basically. It's a big array of antennas, really, waiting to receive photons. Now, a photon is a little packet of light, right? Light has wave-like properties and particle-like properties. A photon is a particle of light. It's a little packet of energy, electromagnetic energy. And when a photon strikes a pigment that is able to absorb that wavelength of photon, that photon, by being absorbed, ceases to exist. It destroys that photon. But of course, it doesn't destroy the energy, right? Energy isn't created or destroyed. So the energy that used to be that photon is transferred to the pigment. And what this causes is excitation of the pigment. By excitation, what I mean is that an electron of that pigment molecule gets sent up at least one energy level, one shell. So that electron has higher energy now. That extra energy used to be in the photon. The photon no longer exists. If you have a bunch of chlorophyll molecules just in solution, in a beaker, and you shine light on them, the light will be absorbed by the photon, by the chlorophyll, which will excite those molecules. But that's an unstable situation, right? Having a higher energy level means more unstable. So immediately those electrons want to come back down to the lower level where they were more stable, and they do that. Well, that reduction in energy when they go to a lower level means that that energy has to go somewhere, right? Once again, it's not destroyed. So a brand new photon is created in that situation, and it gets shown by, S-H-O-N-E, the chlorophyll. In other words, the chlorophyll produces its own light. That's what we call fluorescence. You wouldn't want that to happen in a plant because that's a total waste of the original energy. So photosystems are arranged in such a way that excited chlorophyll molecules are disallowed from fluorescing. I'll tell you what they do with the energy instead next time.